Jewelry doesn't matter, Ronnie said. The coat, though, that was her treasure, smuggled out of the old country way back when. Hey folks, how you doing? I'm Keith Tyler, your volunteer broadcaster. Welcome to the Mystery Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. A real treat to have you with me. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Sam Wiebe bring us our first story, and it's called The Barguzin Sable.
You know I don't ask for much, David, my adopted mother said. Never a good sign when she started calling in markers. The Kozaks up the street need a hand with some detective work.
She said this as if it were any other household chore, like steadying a ladder while her neighbors cleaned out their gutters.
The car's making that noise again, and by the way, could you be a dear and locate a couple of missing persons?
Wakeland and Chin Investigations had all the work a two-person agency could want. My first day off after a 10-day stretch, and I wasn't inclined to give it up. I'd just uncapped a bottle of Buffalo Trace and was flipping through my Apple TV.
I'm pretty busy, Ma, I told her. There's a show on the History Channel about ancient astronauts, how they maybe helped write the Constitution.
That stuff is utter nonsense, David.
Well, probably so, but I'd like to hear them out.
As a police widow who adopted her hippie sister's child, Agnes Wakeland was not one for jokes.
You get over there right now, she said. Ronnie Kozak is cleaning up all by himself. He lost his mother, for Pete's sake.
Oh, lost? How? I asked,
already putting the stopper in the Buffalo Trace.
The police said it was a robbery, home invasion.
Poor Carol Grace got in the way. The Kozak home was on West 21st, a block from my mother's house on Laurel Street. The fourth Saturday of every month, Carol Grace Kozak would make pierogies and halubitsi for the luncheon at the Ukrainian church. The warm smells of starch and cabbage would permeate the block. It smelled like home. Not mine, but as someone who spends most of his life on the outside looking in, I'd always taken comfort from that smell. Like his mother, Ronnie Kozak was stout, fair-haired, and had a perpetual sheen of sweat on his forehead. They both chain-smoked Sobranes and preferred Crown Royal over clear spirits. Unlike his mother, Ronnie had sleeved out his arms with tattoos of barbed wire and three-barred crosses, logos for Pantera and Danzig. His latest addition across his left bicep read, "One day at a damn time." Ronnie was 7 years older than me. I'd once seen him knock a kid's teeth out for insulting his sister, Melanie. Teeth, as in plural. One skittered out during the pull-apart brawl, the other spat it into the hand of his parents who stopped the fight. The door of the house was open. Ronnie was on his knees in the middle of the living room, scrubbing the carpet and sobbing. Ropes of mucus joined the suds on the pink shag.
Hey, Ronnie, I said gently from the doorway. He wiped his face on the front of his shirt and snorted, Hey, Dave, your mom said you'd be over.
Wow, what happened?
Last Thursday afternoon, Carol Grace had been home alone. Ronnie, who had moved back into his old bedroom after his second DUI, was at the Hastings Park racecourse.
Just to have coffee with the guys and go over the sheet for the Breeders' Cup.
From what the police told him, a very brief struggle had occurred in the living room. Carol Grace had been struck once with a blunt object. She'd fallen, clipping the glass coffee table on the way down. Subdural hematoma.
At least it was quick, Ronnie said.
He told me this while he smoked, leaning against the wall, as I took a turn scrubbing on the bloodstain.
Between the dust and the suds and the carpet's salmon color, it was hard to know if I was making any headway. Squirting more stain remover onto the brush, I asked him what the killers had taken. Some jewelry and Mob's sable. I wrote down a list for the cops. Give me a copy, I'll try the pawn shops. The jewelry doesn't matter, Ronnie said. The coat, though, that was her treasure, smuggled out of the old country way back when. Genuine Barguzin sable. Those go for 40-50 grand, sometimes more. He drew on his sobriety, lost in thought. So how's Melanie taking this?
Well, you know Mel, she and Mom weren't close.
I nodded.
Did Carol Grace have any enemies?
No, not a one, Dave. I worked at the carpet. Ronnie Kozak gave a sharp, heartsick moan and started bawling again.
Dave, you gotta find that coat, he said. It's all we have of her, and the person who killed her took it.
The Kozak murder had fallen to the new guy in homicide. Nick Nair didn't smoke or drink, which made plying him for information difficult. He also didn't melt at the dulcet sound of my voice. But where there's a will, there's usually a vice. Nair's was for fine dining. On a cop schedule, with a pandemic raging on, indulging the palate was difficult. I told him I'd meet him after his shift with the best French meal in town. I was fine by him. In the meantime, I hit the pawn shops. Pat Trevino was busy behind the counter at Pat's Gold and Pawn, showing a teenage customer an array of used cell phones. I browsed the garden tools until the teen had made her choice.
"Good to see you, Dave," Pat said. Going on 70, he'd been running the shop since my father had patrolled the commercial drive beat.
The neighborhood had grown up around him, but Pat and his cluttered cubbyhole remained a thumb in the eye of the gentrification crowd.
"What do you know about Barguzin Sable?" I asked.
Pat whistled beneath his mask.
"Whoa, Sable's not something you mess with, not unless you got stars tattooed on your shoulders. Like that movie with Viggo, Morgenstern?
You haven't seen any furs recently?" Pat pointed at a Metallica t-shirt and a replica Canucks jersey hanging behind the counter.
You want, search my extensive clothing selection.
"Who knows about this stuff?" I asked.
Pat scratched his ear, then immediately slapped the dispenser of hand sanitizer. He rubbed his palms together.
"Well, furriers are kind of weird folks, Dave. Their clients are the super elite. You got 15-20 grand to blow on a used Barguzin sable, yeah, you probably got 40 to shell out for a new one."
"They really go for that much?"
Pat shrugged. "You can't expect common sense from folks who wear weasel."
"A sable is a marten, not a weasel," Lita Yuan said with irritation. She stood on the sidewalk at a distance from me, smoking a thin black cigar. Her narrow Robson Street shopfront was closed while she was outside. 50-ish, tall and slender, with a hint of the English school system in her voice, Lita was a one-woman business.
"A fur isn't something you can toss into a garment bag for 20 years and expect it to hold its value," she said. "They needed to be stored correctly, maintained. The qualities that made a good sable make it somewhat delicate."
"Is it true they can go for north of 50 grand? Lita smiled at my naivete.
"Mr. Wakeland, a true Barguzin sable can fetch several times that."
"For a skin?"
"For the right skin. The Russian government controls the sable trade, maintaining a virtual monopoly. It's always been so. In pre-revolutionary Russia, only the Tsar and Tsarina could wear sable."
"So someone's buying this today? It's kind of a form of dress-up."
If we'd been closer, no doubt she would have exhaled cigar smoke in my face.
"You must have been told before that you can be rather annoying."
Lots, but can't listen to your critics. You don't have a Barguzin sable in stock?
Nobody in Vancouver does.
Say one became available. You'd be the person to contact?
Well, I'd be at the top of the very exclusive list, Lita said.
At 7 o'clock, I drove one of the Wakeland and Shen work vans to the police lot under the Cambie Bridge where Nick Nair appeared in his civilian clothes. I waved him over. He sat in the passenger seat while I passed him the warming dishes from St. Lawrence.
Vol-au-vent en champignon to start, I said. Cuisse de lapin braise with hunter sauce, sugar pie for dessert.
Well, this is better than skip the dishes, Nair said, digging in. The PI thing doesn't pan out. You should be a food driver.
As he ate, I quizzed him about Carol Grace Kozak's homicide. I was hoping for a clue, a large multi-stranded neon-lit clue like the Christmas decorations already going up in mid-November.
Yeah, no luck.
The lightweight metal object Carol Grace had been struck with was still unidentified.
Going off carpet fibers, Nair said between bites. The scuffle happened first. She hit the ground, and the killer went upstairs for the jewels.
And the sable? I said.
Yeah, right. There's no receipt or anything for that, so it's hard to know its value, other than the sentimental kind.
How'd the killer get inside? I asked.
Front door. No forced entry, so either she let him in or left it unlocked. Her son says she did that sometimes.
Used to be that kind of neighborhood, so no break-in and the killer went straight to the bedroom?
From what I can tell, they didn't leave breadcrumbs.
The blow that killed Mrs. Kozak, I said.
Tall person, short, strong. How hard did they swing?
Well, hard enough. Nair disposed of the entree and moved to the pie.
She was struck on the crown of the head, so the killer must have been tall. Well, taller than her in any case.
You knew the lady, huh?
Yeah, my mother's neighbor, I said. Her son had his problems.
Yeah, Ronnie's a recovering alcoholic.
So no doubt he knows a few skells.
Nair forked a piece of pie into his mouth and made an orgasmic face.
Oh, the crust on this. Anyway, he didn't get much out of the daughter. Melanie, not a real warm relationship. You know what their beef was about?
Her sex life, I said.
What aspect? Her mother didn't like her having one.
Nair nodded.
Yeah, I got one of those, too. Mom and Dad think I'm saving it for marriage.
Hard having parents, I said.
I was thinking of Melanie Kozak, trying to remember how tall she was.
6 feet? 6'1"?
Tall enough to swing something down on her mother's head.
In point of fact, Mel was a shade under 6'2".
6 years my senior. She was smart, driven, and moved with a poise none of the other Kozaks possessed.
At 40, she still had it.
Seated behind her desk on the 9th floor of the Melville Street office, she pointed me to a client's chair that proved as uncomfortable as it looked. She and her ex were still business partners.
The problem with an open marriage isn't the open part, Mel said.
I didn't and don't care who Reuben brings to bed. It's the marriage part that doomed us, putting each other first.
But you're not here to talk about that.
No, I'm sorry it didn't work out, I said, and I'm very sorry about your mother.
Mel sighed.
Oh, Carol Grace, she said, as if the name was difficult to recall.
When did you last see her?
Oh, a year or so. She'd twisted her ankle and needed me to pick up Ronnie from rehab, as if the little twit couldn't take the bus.
Any idea who would do this?
Mel shook her head. It was a robbery. Carol Grace got in the way, and a story.
She stood up, almost 6'2" of her, stretched and pulled a file off the cabinet.
Kozak Ruiz managed the portfolios of hockey stars, direct-to-download filmmakers, and other less glamorous clientele, one of whom needed Mel's attention.
"You know anyone who wears sable?" I asked.
Mel flipped page, paused. "You're referring to Carol Grace's coat? You know she never let me so much as even try it on? Not once."
"I don't know much about sables," I said. "Last night I rented Gorky Park, but all I learned was that a Russian accent is tough to maintain for 2 hours."
Mel put the file down and walked back to her desk, heels clicking, bent, and extracted a checkbook.
"I'll tell you what, Dave," she said. "If you can recover the coat, I'll pay you $10,000, expenses included."
"Supposedly it's worth a lot more than that."
Melanie Kozak held up the check and fixed me with a smile. At 14, I would have taken on that Russian government for a smile like that.
"There's no crime against being shrewd," she said. "The coat's an heirloom, and rightfully mine. And if it's worth more, well, don't I deserve the bargain?"
Over the phone, Ronnie admitted that, yeah, he'd shown the sable to one or two people. Close friends only, no one you could rightly call a suspect.
"Trina likes nice furs and stuff, so one day when Mom was at church, I took her up to Mom's room and showed her. But I was super careful, made her wash her hands first."
"Trina, your girlfriend?" I asked.
"Well, ex. We met in one of those courses you take before they give you back your license. Hit it off right away. Trina actually lived with us for a while."
According to Ronnie, Carol Grace didn't have a problem with her son's girlfriend living under her roof. They actually got along most of the time.
"Didn't like her dog much, though," he said. "Trina has this little yappy pocket rat named Doug. She doesn't believe in crate training, thinks it's cruel, and when Doug gets nervous, he tends to let one go. Mom hated cleaning up after Doug."
Saint Carol of Assisi, I thought.
"And what happened with Trina?"
"Turns out we weren't good at keeping each other sober. She's with this new guy, Wayne, who I thought was her friend at first, else I wouldn't have showed it to him."
"Wayne saw the sable, too."
"Yeah,"
Ronnie sounded a little abashed.
"He has a table at the flea market, knows the value of things. Trina thought he'd get a kick out of it."
"And you didn't tell the police about them?"
"Kind of friend you think I am, Dave. Both Trina and Wayne have records. They don't need that kind of scrutiny."
The Vancouver flea market has a permanent weekend home in the long red barn on Terminal Avenue. Since the outbreak of COVID, the market had been attempting to social distance and sanitized. Mask on, I waited in line to pay my admission, then walked through the aisles of cluttered folding tables, feeling the vendors watching me. Trina Vance had been arrested several times for petty theft and minor narcotics dealing. Her face was masked, but her hair, shoulder length, and electric orange stood out from the other side of the barn. Wayne, no last name provided, loomed over a table of record crates and Frederick Remington statuettes. His gray-black beard was shot through with what looked like tobacco juice. He was chewing, maskless, watching an elderly goth flip through Bowie albums. Behind Trina and Wayne was a clothes rack on which hung various military and Starfleet uniforms, some still with costume department tags.
"Looking for something nice for my girl," I said.
"Any furs?"
Wayne horked and spat into a coffee tin.
"What's there is what's there."
Trina swatted through the clothes rack, pulling out a white stole, one end of which looked like it had been dusted with blue Kool-Aid.
"This ought to get her going."
I shook my head. "No.
Way nicer. Something high-end. Price, no objection." A look passed between them that could have meant any number of things.
I knew what it meant.
"How nice we talking?" Trina asked.
I leaned over conspiratorially.
"Well, let's say a guy's ship came in, and let's say his woman he likes, well, she has a thing for fancy furs, mink or, what's the other one?"
"Ermine," Trina said.
"Sable? Oh, yeah, now you're talking."
Another look between them.
"Does Mr. Ship came in got a number in mind?" Wayne asked.
"Well, first he'd have to see the coat. If it does the trick, he's willing to open up the wallet as far as it goes." Wayne nodded, spat.
"I maybe have something that'll fit. No promises. Meet me out back."
"To Trina," he said. "You show him where, babe." There's a certain type of error when your hypervigilance for an elaborate con leaves you wide open for a sort of a stupid one. I was prepared for any number of bait-and-switch scams, skunk pelts passed off as sable, even a gun being pulled when we set up an exchange. I wasn't expecting a blow on the head from Trina the second the side door closed behind us. A mugging in broad daylight, especially stupid, so what did that make me? I struck the side mirror of a pickup as I went down, kneeling in a puddle as Trina handed a weighted sock to Wayne and took my wallet.
"Oh, man," she said, "the dude's a P.I.
"I knew it," Wayne said.
"You don't know crap from Parmesan, Wayne. Second I saw him, I thought something was off."
"Well, I'm glad you spoke up in time." I moaned and put a steadying hand down, breaking the gasoline scum on a puddle. $40 and a company visa," Wayne said, bending to me. "Where's your money guy?"
"He's got a cell phone," Trina said.
Wayne took it and dropped it immediately. Thing was any older, it'd have a rotary dial. We were corralled between trucks, but I could hear conversation from somewhere nearby. Wayne glanced around. As he did, I took hold of his belt and drove a short uppercut into his balls. He let out a whinny and dropped what he was holding. A broken roll of quarters spilled out of the mouth of the sock like the world's saddest jackpot. Trina was running. Wayne fought to his feet and limped after her. I could have struggled up and given pursuit. That would have been the heroic thing to do. But I still had my wallet, and judging from the quarters, I'd made $20 on the deal. Heroism can't compete with change for the laundry. Carol Grace Kozak's funeral was on Sunday. I spotted Detective Nair in a back pew of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, surveilling the other attendees. We nodded at each other. Ronnie sat up front in a Harley-Davidson tee beneath a black blazer. He cried during the service, and a friend of his mother's leaned over and handed him a handkerchief, which he sobbed into loudly for the duration. Mel sat with an empty seat between her and her brother, in a veiled morning dress that showed off her legs. She looked downcast and tired. After the service, I left my mother's side to pull them both into an alcove. After a suitable expression of sympathy, I said, "How much are you in debt, Ronnie?" He hugged himself, sniffed.
I've been working on it. When I totaled my car, Mom helped me with the payments. I still owe her $600 or $700. She was keeping track, and Mel," he nodded but didn't look at his sister, "I owe her maybe four.
$4,250, Mel said, "plus half the internment fee."
I nodded, and, "How about you?"
"Debt?" Oh, Mel feigned confusion. "I don't owe a red cent."
"Last 6 months, Kozak Ruiz lost 7 big clients. I checked."
"It's to be expected. The comfort level for risk is down. People are socking their money away."
I couldn't help but think of Trina's quarters. "Once you two sell the house, it's a substantial inheritance."
"I can't think about that right now," Mel said.
"Any luck finding Carol Grace's coat?" When I shook my head, she added, "Then I really should circulate before I leave. I can't have Carol Grace's friends thinking she raised 2 complete ingrates."
Ronnie watched her go.
"She's real messed up about this," he said. "She and Mom never got to patch things up. I always felt like such a loser moving back in with her, but now I'm glad I had that time.
Unanswered prayers, huh, Dave?" My phone now made a chattering sound, even when set to vibrate. I excused myself to answer it. Lita Yuan asked if there was a Mr. Wakeland there, and if he was still interested in the matter of a Barguzian sable. I raised my hand to catch Nair's attention. He is, and yes, still interested. Did one show up?
It will tonight, Lita said. A woman called who said her name was Haley. It might be an alias, of course. This is all very exciting.
Oh, sure is, I said, mouthing the word sable to Nair. What's this Haley want?
Well, first, there were some questions about my business, whether I dealt in used furs, etc. Something about her tone made me suspicious.
Lita's voice jangled with excitement.
She said she'd inherited a sable from her aunt, and what were they worth, ballpark? When I told her it depends on any number of criteria, Haley said it was a Barguzin and absolutely mint. She knew it was worth 50 or 60, but I wouldn't let it go for 25 in cash. I assume she meant thousands. I told her that was steep for a used garment and suggested if it was a genuine Barguzin, 5 to 10 might be an appropriate range. A low figure, Mr. Wakefield, but I had to keep acting as a hard-driven sales lady or Haley would have suspected something.
Lita Day Lewis.
What did she say? I asked.
We settled on 35 in cash tonight at 9 back of my shop.
Haley will bring the coat and I'll have the cash ready in a nondescript bag. No funny business, no alerting the cops. Her words.
Nair stood next to me, waiting as I told Lita how to handle Haley if she called back.
Oh, this is exhilarating, Lita said. My little shop, the site of an honest-to-goodness sting. It's an invigorating line of work you're in, Mr. Wakeland.
A thrill a minute, I said. By 9 o'clock, I was set up in the back room of Lita's shop, which served as office, storeroom, break room, and workshop for minor alterations. As flawless as the showroom looked, the back was thoroughly junked. Floor to ceiling with trade magazines, bolts of cloth, gleaming supplies, and a pair of glossy black headless mannequins. Lita drank cup after cup of instant coffee, occasionally coming back to microwave her mug for a 30-second reheat. She was flitting around the store, trying to keep busy, a pinball of caffeinated anxiety. I sat at her desk with a thermos of Earl Grey and a dented old police flashlight that had been my father's. The tools of the trade, a hot beverage, and a bludgeon. Nair and his partner were up the block watching the showroom on the camera they'd installed. Given more time, no doubt, the detectives would have set up a proper operation. There'd be real money, marked and accounted for. Lita would be replaced by an undercover officer who could pull off the fashionable look. But Nair was coming into this in medias res. If it worked out, he'd have the killer in less time than it took to type up the proposal, let alone get authorization for it. That was reality of the detective business, as slow as the formation of sediment layers and then too fast to exercise control. I drank tea, did what I could, waited. 9:20, the door shuddered from a fist on the glass. Lita unlocked the door for a woman of maybe 40, below blonde hair going gray. Her mask was a generic hospital blue. Not at all what I expected. Prim was the word that came to mind. A dark green button-down suit, large buckled belt on high-waisted slacks, and a suede jacket with white fur trimming the collar.
"We spoke on the phone," she said.
"We did," Lita responded. "Haley, is it?" Both Nair and I had stressed that when she let Haley into the shop, Lita was not to relock the door, leave it not just unlocked, but clearly unlocked. A cornered person will opt to fight if they think escape is out of the question. The coat wasn't worth it. But in the moment of forgetfulness or bravery or mischief, Lita threw the lock and removed the key.
"Let's talk over here," she said, positioning herself so that Haley would be centered below Nair's camera.
I could see them both through the cracked door to the back.
I'm supposed to pick up some money, Haley said. She squinted directly at me. The lights were off in the back room, and I knew I was invisible to her. It was still disconcerting. Haley's head snapped around to follow Lita's, her hands in her coat. Nervous. I need to see the merchandise first, Lita said, to know what it is I'm buying. No merch, no money. I didn't know what TV script Lita was working from, but ultimatums only serve to raise tensions. Better to let Haley walk and follow her than to risk a confrontation. But maybe that's what Lita wanted. The big gun down. Haley whipped something from her pocket and leveled it at Lita. I started to the door but noticed her palm was glowing. The screen of a phone. She held it to Lita's face. You can see I'm not dicking you around, Haley said. Genuine Barguzinski stable. Oh, looks to be in elegant condition, Leah admitted. The grain is truly exquisite. You'll make a fortune off of this, Haley said. After I get the 13.5, otherwise we have someone else lined up. Not sure I believe that, Lita said. In any case, I'll have to get the money from my office.
As Lita moved toward me, beckoning the woman, Haley's head ratcheted around to stare through the storefront. Something happening outside. The red and blue lights atop Nair's unmarked began to spin wildly. An old Chevy van banged into a parking meter, its front swinging perpendicular to the street. Exhaust clouded the shop windows as the van spun its tires, the horrendous sounds of metal on metal, of glass popping. Haley was banging on the door. Lita was trying to restrain her. I quickly stepped between them, catching shots fore and aft. Haley clawed at my arm. She kicked at the glass, calling to her father to surrender himself. As the engine cut off and the exhaust diffused over Robeson Street, I saw the logo on the side of the van. Nair had his gun pointed at the driver. He told Pat Trevino to step down slowly. Palms out. Easy now. In the end, soap and stain remover hadn't been enough. Ronnie had cut a Hudson's Bay-shaped segment of the mother's carpet. The hardwood boards below needed a wash and a polish, but looked a million times better than the pink shag rug. We sat in Carol Grace's living room, Ronnie and Mel and myself, waiting for Nair to swing by with a sable. The open bay window allowed a drizzly December morning into the room. The Kozaks had little to say to one another. Mel thumbed her phone while Ronnie paced and smoked. I was there for support because my mother had asked me to be, and to receive my 10 grand from Mel, I was also curious. Not every day you see a garment worth killing for. Pat Trevino had confessed, in order to clear his daughter, at the track one day he'd overheard Ronnie mention the coat. Pat had taken a ride to Carol Grace's house on the pretense of a free jewelry appraisal. When he brought up the subject of the sable, she refused to let him see it, gotten suspicious, and ordered him out. Sensing the value, Pat had struck her with his jeweler's micrometer, breaking the calipers on her skull. He'd taken the sable along with the jewels and left. According to Pat, it was his first and only crime, but Nair had discovered a strong box in the back of Pat's gold and pawn. Inside were items listed on several burglary sheets, along with a watch linked to another homicide. Nair's unmarked appeared at the curb. The three of us watched him stroll up to the door of the garment bag over his shoulder. 50-50, right? Ronnie said to his sister. Less what you owe Carol Grace's estate. Whatever, he said. But you're paying Dave out of your half. I only asked him to find it. I never officially offered him a reward. Before he spoke, I knew my fortunes weren't changing appreciably that day. It was clear from the way Nair was carrying the bag, professionally but without delicacy or reverence. Water papped on the plastic from the overhang. Hey, careful with that, Ronnie said. He forced his way past me, past Mel. He seized the bag from Nair without much of a thank you, unzipped it, and let out an agonized yowl.
It was a rich, silvery butterscotch, the fur vibrant, free of moth bites or dust or whatever dangerous face of vintage fur.
It looked fit for a czarina, a stout one. It was stupidly beautiful.
Ronnie repeated his cry and gripped the collar as if he might tear it off.
"You can never get that out," he said. "Worthless, worthless."
He dropped it on the couch and stalked away. Nair and I exchanged a look, two palace servants relaying bad news. He shrugged and waved at me and left.
"Utterly worthless," Ronnie said.
I couldn't see why he was right, but I could smell why perfectly. It gave off the scent of the house, of her. 10,000 meals and 500,000 cigarettes had thoroughly cured the fur. The Kozak kids could splash it with Febreze and maybe get a grand or two from a flea market customer if they were patient. But it would never be valued higher. I heard Ronnie thudding upstairs to his room, slamming the door. "Mike, you to leave." I said goodbye to Mel, but she didn't hear me. She'd been staring at the sable from the edge of the easy chair. Now, virtually alone with it, Mel approached the sable and picked it up, almost trepidatiously. Eyes shimmering, she lowered her face to it and inhaled, filling herself with the smell.
"Oh, Mom," she said.
Very good, very well, very wonderful. Okay, I'm going to the Playboy Book of Crime and Suspense. A story by Gerald Kirsch, and it's called A Lucky Day for the Boar.
"Well, what the devil then? Where's your title?"
said Mr. Bozeman, the proprietor of the Baltimore General Press.
"I see a quotation. Incoscito serpe aldatere nunquam tibi," which construed reads, "Forgive others often, but never forgive yourself." "Well?"
His editor, a timid man, murmured, I advance the gentleman $5.
"Gentleman? What the devil kind of alpaca and steel mixture hack do you call gentleman? And what do you mean by $5? How dare you do it, sir? Silver is dug out of the ground. It does not grow on bushes, eh? Eh?"
"Well, we might entitle it A Lucky Day for the Boar, sir."
"You make free with my dollars, sir. Read it over to me, mister, if you will."
"By your leave," said the editor, and read. Self-sufficient, Colonel Hyrax came and went like a cat in the Duke's palace. Nobody could deny that there was, in fact, much of the feline in his fastidiousness and in his almost inhuman composure. As chief of the secret police, Colonel Hyrax was not bound by the rules of protocol. Dread followed him and awe. Awe of the unknown, and it was whispered that the Duke himself feared Colonel Hyrax. Certainly no one but he would have dared to detain the Duke when that potentate was booted and spurred for the hunt. Yet although he was smiling with pleasurable anticipation as he listened to the baying of his boarhounds in the courtyard below, the Duke had put aside his boar spear when Colonel Hyrax appeared and, bidding him close the door, asked,
"What now, Hyrax?"
"Your Grace, I have good news."
My forester have beaten out a black boar of 30 stone, a monster, so be brief. Good news of what?
Of the conspiracy, your grace, the Colonel Hyrax said.
Oh, I suppose, said the Duke with a harsh laugh. I suppose you're going to tell me that my traitorous scoundrel of a nephew has named his partners in this plot against me?
Precisely that, your grace, said Colonel Hyrax with a thin smile.
No!
By your grace's leave.
Yes, cried Colonel
By your grace's leave, yes, cried Colonel Hyrax. But he looked in vain for some demonstration of relief or joy. The Duke frowned.
It is hard, he said. It is very hard for me to believe. Are you sure now my nephew Stanislaus has named his friends?
Your grace, I have a list of their names. They are under close arrest.
Oh, damn it! Stanislaus is my blood. He had, I thought he had, something of my character. Red Heart pincers could not drag a betrayal out of my friends, out of me. Milksop!
Yet he conspired against the life of your grace, said Colonel Hyrax.
I know, but that was all in the family. I trapped him, and he didn't lie about it. Naturally, he refused to name his collaborators. I'd have done the same in his place. Oh, yes, Hyrax. Touching the matter of red-hot pincers, you never dared.
I know my duty, your grace, said Colonel Hyrax. I am well aware that your blood is inviolable, and that it is death to spill one drop of it, or to offer violence, however slight, to any member of your family, or even to threaten it. Well, neither may any of your grace's blood be manacled. Oh, believe me, not only was His Excellency your nephew treated with the utmost gentleness, I saw to it, when he was placed in solitary confinement by your grace's written order, that he could not even do violence to his own person.
And still he betrayed his comrades? He's no blood of mine.
The Duke then uttered foul accusations against his dead brother's wife. Growing calmer, he said,
All right, more, Hyrax, tell me more.
The horns sounded clear in the courtyard, but the Duke threw open the casement and roared,
Let the boar wait!
Your grace sentenced your nephew to perpetual solitary confinement. His Excellency was to be left to cool his head, to quote your own words.
Did you starve him, Hyrax? You had no right to starve the boy.
Oh, no, your grace. He had everything of the best. The passage of time did our work for us, said Colonel Hyrax.
Time? What time?
The young fool hasn't been locked up 2 months. What are you talking about? If I may explain, begged Colonel Hyrax, and his master nodding, he continued. I had prepared for His Excellency a commodious chamber, padded at walls, floor, and ceiling with heavy quiltings of lamb's wool, covered with gray velvet. There was a double window out of which His Excellency might look at the wild countryside surrounding the fortress.
Well, better than he deserved.
His viands were, as I have said, of the best. But his meat was cut for him, and all his cutlery consisted of a horn spoon. For he was so violent at first that I feared the young gentleman might do himself a mischief.
Aye, he always was an overbred, nervous young fool. Well?
Then we asked His Excellency for permission to shave his head, said Colonel Hyrax. He gave it.
What the devil for?
Your grace will see presently. So by his leave we shaved off all of his hair. We provided him with some quills, ink and paper, but nothing edged or pointed. To calm him, a mild and harmless opiate was mixed in with His Excellency's breakfast. He ate, and then, leaning on the casement, gazed moodily at the landscape under the morning sun. He dozed, leaning thus, for perhaps 5 minutes.
When he opened his eyes, he was looking upon the night scene with a rising moon, and the attendants were bringing him his supper. His Excellency was bewildered. "I am bewitched," he asked. But since, by your grace's order, he was incommunicado, the attendants were silent.
"Bewildered," cried the Duke, "so am I. From breakfast to supper, morning to moonrise, in matter of hours, what was the purpose of bringing Stanislaus his supper 5 minutes after breakfast time?"
"Pray let me explain, your grace. The prospect beyond his window was not open country. It was a blank wall upon which I had caused to be projected through a lens by means of a powerful reflector, highly realistic scenes painted upon glass by one of the finest landscape artists in Europe. Thus I could create a perfect illusion of the various stages of the day and of the four seasons."
"Oh, but what for?"
"In order, your grace, without violating your law, to let his excellency confuse himself in his conception of time. Soon he fell into a deep sleep, and an adroit barber shaved him and trimmed his nails. Men incarcerated can gauge time to a certain extent by the rate of growth of their beards, you see. It was necessary to bewilder. It was necessary to let his excellency force himself to have recourse to reason and to make his reasoning invalid. Do I make myself clear?"
"Oh, go on."
"Hence he would awaken, let us say, at midnight, look out the window and see high noon, doze again, rise again in 10 minutes, and lo and behold, dawn. Or awakening at dawn, he would see nothing but the rim of the setting sun, while the attendants came in with supper. Sleeping soon after, by the judicious administration of opiates, he would start up to observe another sunset. So, after a week, he asked how many months had he been there. There was no reply, of course."
"Oh, clever, clever," said the Duke.
Colonel Hyrax bowed and continued, "Although the month was July, His Excellency awoke one morning to a scene of naked trees under a blanket of snow. Sometimes breakfast, dinner, and supper would arrive at intervals of only a few minutes after the clearing of the table, or sometimes hours might elapse, after which His Excellency, starting out of a fitful sleep, might notice that it was early autumn now, where it had been midwinter when he last looked out. I took good care, since men in prison sometimes grow preternaturally observant, to age the guards and waiters and to see to it that their uniforms showed increasing signs of wear. The chief warder was always accompanied by a pair of great dogs. At first, it was a couple of wolfhounds. I replaced these with older and older wolfhounds. Then there was a new young warder, and he had a pair of mastiffs, which, in their turn, I made appear to grow old by a system of substitution. Well, naturally, I never entered the young gentleman's chamber myself, but I had my reports to rely upon. Your Grace, within a few weeks, your nephew believed he had been incarcerated for an incomputable number of years."
"Your Grace has had the nightmare, no doubt," the Duke said. "I have, and it's horrible. A second is an eternity, or worse. I think I understand you now, Hyrax. Oh, go on."
"By means of concealed lamps, there was always a diffused light in the chamber, which, by the judicious use of hot air pipes, was maintained at a constant temperature of precisely 74 degrees Fahrenheit. As His Excellency slept, his clothes were taken away and replaced with others, precisely the same in pattern, but just a little more worn. I also arranged that his clothes should be made progressively a hair's breadth larger, so that the young gentleman grew gradually convinced that he was becoming shriveled and wasted with long imprisonment."
"Oh, clever, clever!" cried the Duke with a slight shudder.
I think that, on the whole, given the choice, I'd choose the iron boot and thumbscrew or the rack. Oh, proceed.
Ah, but there is no question of choice, Your Grace, for this method of mine depends for its effectiveness upon complete ignorance of the surrounding circumstances. Do I make myself clear?
Your object being to plant a firm illusion that there has been a prolonged passage of time when, as a matter of fact, only hours have elapsed, said the Duke.
Just so, said Hyrax. I have written a carefully annotated procedure for Your Grace's perusal. I can make 4 minutes last 48 hours. In the consciousness of the prisoner, I hasten to reassure Your Grace that no common hand was laid on His Excellency, your nephew Stanislaus. His table was almost as well furnished as Your Grace's own, only he had the delicacies of the season out of season, and allowing for certain inevitable margins of error, the young gentleman seemed to live a long month in half an hour. Between Your Grace's breakfast and dinner he passed approximately a whole year.
Well, said the Duke, that may teach the pup a lesson, not to plot against his poor old uncle, who used to think the world of him. Well, now, come to the point. What made Stanislaus betray his friends?
They are my enemies, it is true, but, well, I think the worse of him, notwithstanding.
Colonel Hyrax said, but His Excellency did not betray his friends, Your Grace.
Will you tell me the devil what you are talking about? Roared the Duke.
I mean he did not betray them willingly.
Oh, if you have deranged the rascal with some of your dirty drugs, began the Duke.
No, no, Your Grace. The drugs were used discreetly and sparingly, and then only for the first 3 weeks. Time was the illusion, with which I took the liberty of bedazzling the young gentleman. Time, as man knows it, through the contemplation of mere external change. Men and fashions seem to come and go. Once, on my order, a guard let fall a newspaper. It was post-dated 15 years. I had had one copy only, printed before the type was broken up, and it was full of news of people and affairs His Excellency had never heard of.
"Most clever!" exclaimed the Duke. "And my poor, I mean that wretched fellow who is supposed to be my brother's son, and couldn't even keep faith with his fellow criminals, did he write nothing?"
"Only some verses, Your Grace."
"About me?"
"About worms. But I see that Your Grace is anxious to be after the boar, so I will conclude for now. After the young gentleman had been in that chamber about 40 days, the door was opened by a young officer in a strange uniform, gray-faced with yellow, and an older officer in the same colors but having a dolman trimmed with sable, came in, fell on his knees, and hailed your nephew as martyr, savior, and leader. The Duke, he said, was dead. The new party was in power, and Stanislaus was to sit on your throne. The Duke laughed.
Ha! And I suppose my nephew jumped for joy.
Oh, not so, Your Grace, he said, and I quote, so you will forgive me, he said, the old ruffian was kind to me once a time. Then he said, and all my friends, I suppose, are dead or old, which is worse.
Aha! Cried the Duke. We are coming to it now.
Yes, Your Grace. The commanding officer said, if you shall tell me whom you mean, Your Excellency, I shall immediately ascertain. Whereupon your nephew recited a list of 40 names, which are on the paper which I have the honor to place in Your Grace's hand.
Hyrax, said the Duke, you are hellishly clever. And my nephew, how is he?
I was listening to the proceedings in a concealed aperture, and did not see His Excellency at first. Then, when he came into my range of vision, I was astounded, for where a few weeks before I had seen a sanguine young man of 24, I now beheld a decrepit and enfeebled man of 60. The Duke was silent. Colonel Hyrax pointed to the paper upon which the names of the conspirators were written. "Your Grace will hang them?" he asked.
No, I shall shock the wits out of them by pardoning them and making 40 friends into the bargain. Where is Stanislaus?
Asleep, Your Grace, said Colonel Hyrax.
You are an astonishingly clever man, Hyrax, said the Duke. Did I not say that if you cleared this matter up, I'd make a nobleman of you?
The work is of its own reward, Your Grace, said Hyrax.
No, you have earned my gratitude. I hereby confer upon you the barony of Opa, with all lands, rents, and revenues pertaining thereunto.
Oh, your grace, words cannot express.
Oh, no, save them. Leave me now.
Hyrax, having bowed himself out of his presence, the duke called for his secretary. A soberly attired gentleman came in and made his obeisance.
Your grace.
Colonel Hyrax is now Colonel the Baron Opa. Make a note of it.
Yes, your grace.
The duke paced the floor, tugging at his beard.
And write me an order to the Lord Provost, he said. Write as follows. Bearing in mind the new dignity of Colonel Hyrax, whom we have recently created Baron of Opa, you will procure a silk cord and hang him forthwith.
Scrawling his signature at the foot of this document, and impressing the warm wax with his great carnelian ring, the duke muttered,
One could no longer sleep with such a man awake. He is too clever by half.
A nameless cold had crept into his heart. He looked long and anxious at the morning sun and listened with more than usual attention to the portentous ticking of the great bronze clock. Presently he said to his secretary,
Dismiss the men. I hunt no boar today.
Yes, your grace.
I desire to see Stanislaus.
Shall he be sent for?
No, I'll go to him.
The secretary, a good-hearted man, ventured to ask,
Oh, please, your grace, is it your gracious intention magnanimously to pardon the unhappy young gentleman?
The duke growled, No, my grace's intention is humbly to beg the unlucky young gentleman out of his magnanimity to pardon me.
The proprietor said,
You gave this person $5, you say?
He asked 20, said the editor.
I'll advance him 5. And what does the confounded author call himself?
Ethan Arthur Poland. Confidentially, I think he's the man who wrote The Raven, Edgar Poe, no less.
You throw my dollars about like rice at a wedding, my friend. Yes, you have my leave to print. Let the fellow have 5 more, if he presses. A Latin title is a drug, sir, a drug. Take a title out of context, said Mr. Bozeman. And since I'm paying for the job and writing it too, sign it Bozeman, John Helliwell Bozeman. Incidentally, you owe me $5.
So saying, the proprietor of the Baltimore General Press walked sedately out of doors.
Well, friends, I'm out of time. This is Keith Tyler saying thanks for joining me on the Mystery Hour, and tune in again next time, would you please? Thanks. Make sure your I love yous are in order. So long.